Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Over the span of 50 years, Charles Schulz created a comic strip that's one of the indisputable glories of American popular culture. Hilarious, poignant, inimitable. Some 25 years after the last strip appeared, the characters Schulz brought to life in Peanuts continue to resonate with millions of fans. Their four-panel adventures and television escapades offering lessons about happiness, friendship, disappointment, childhood, and life itself. In the Peanuts papers, 33 writers and artists, including Ira Glass and Ann Patchett, reflect on the deeper truths of Schulz's deceptively simple comic, its impact on their lives and art, and on the broader culture. And so today we revisit our conversation from January of 2020 with the editor, Andrew Blauner, following the news.
This episode of Access Utah first aired January 2020.
Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Over the span of 50 years, Charles Schulz created a comic strip that's one of the indisputable glories of American popular culture. Hilarious, poignant, inimitable. Some 20 years after the last strip appeared, the characters Schulz brought to life in Peanuts continue to resonate with millions of fans. Their four-panel adventures and television escapades offering lessons about happiness, friendship, disappointment, childhood, and life itself. In a new collection, the Peanuts Papers, 33 writers and artists, including Ira Glass, Ann Patchett, and others, reflect on the deeper truths of Schulz's deceptively simple comic, its impact on their lives and art, and on the broader culture. Today on Access Utah, we're going to talk with collections editor Andrew Blauner. Andrew Blauner, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
So if people don't know, Andrew Blauner, you're a literary agent, also editor of several previous anthologies.
That's true. I guess I'm moonlighting in a way. My day job, as it were, is as a literary agent representing writers and their books. And then as these really, truly labors of love, pet projects, I put together these anthologies, these collections on themed subjects, typically on topics that are near and dear to me, and nothing fits that description more than Peanuts.
So I understand you got to meet Charles Schulz. This was in the last year of his life. How did that come about?
I didn't realize how unusual and surreal and special it was going to be, and it was at the time. I first wrote to him in 1996, in my capacity as a literary agent, representing another anthology called Our Mother's Spirits. It's a collection of men writing essays about their mothers and the death of their mothers. And I'd seen an interview with Schulz, who was sort of well-known to be very stoic, but when he got to the subject of his mom, he got quite emotional, and something resonated there. So I just thought, I'll take a flyer and take a chance, just why not write to him on behalf of my client, whose name was Bob Blauner, strangely not a relative, asking if Mr. Schulz would consider writing an essay about his mom for Bob's collection. And it was before the internet or email, and one day I saw a letter from, I think the address was One Snoopy Way, and I thought, that's nice. He had an assistant at least write, you know, a polite form letter. And yet, sure enough, it was a declination. I mean, he as politely as humanly possible said, thank you, but no thanks, to writing for that book. But something to the effect of, if you ever find yourself in Santa Rosa, California, please stop by. It'd be great to meet. And I thought, I'm calling that bluff, like, if that's what it is. I'm going to plan a trip to happen to be in Santa Rosa, California. And it took about 2 years or so, but come 1999, there I was in his office, sitting there chatting for a better part of an afternoon. And so, on some level, the seeds of this book were planted there, and that's, you know, a little bit more than 20 years ago. And we kept in touch. Yes, the last year of his life, sort of brief kind of pen pal relationship.
What was he like?
Gentle, kind, quiet, everything that. You know, you read about, but kind of almost, not cynically, but thought, how could he be insecure? How could he be some of the things he was known to be? And yet he was. He just, he was grateful for what he had, and he, you know, he had strong points of view, though, and he, you know, he didn't want anyone drawing the strip after he kept doing it. If you suggested an idea, that was almost a surefire way that he was not. If you said, oh, well, you should do a strip where Linus and Lucy are doing such and such, that everything had to come from him. But my experience of him was unconditionally of a man who was just kind and generous and sweet. I still have no idea to this day why he took that meeting and took that time, but I'm so grateful.
Hmm. It seems like he's bound up in the strips, bound up in him. In fact, almost incredibly, I remember there was an announcement the strip's going to end, had health problems, and almost immediately on the heels of that, we learned of his death.
Well, you either did have great researchers or did great due diligence, or you just are a fan and, you know, remember everything, because that's exactly right. There was something to the fact that throughout the course of his life, or at least career, he said, I am the strip, and the strip is me. I'm not Charlie Brown. I'm not Snoopy. I'm sort of everything I have to say, I say through the strip. People wanted him to write, you know, memoirs and books of his own and op-ed pieces and take positions on things. And so, yes, he was inextricably linked with the strip and it with him. And so, yes, exactly as you put it, he because of his health, he announced he was going to stop doing the strip. And depending what market you were in, within 24 hours of when the final strip was published, he died, as if something cosmically, karmically was at play there.
Hmm. Do you think that contributes to the, universal nature of that? He didn't explain the strip, right? The strip stands on its own.
That's exactly right, yeah. You asked me what he was like. I found him to be utterly unpretentious and authentic. And I would write to him and, you know, I'd see the announcement for the Pulitzer Prizes and I'd see that there'd be one for political cartooning. And I'd write to him and say, hey, you know, don't you think there should be a Pulitzer for people who do what you do? And he'd say, you know, thanks, but I'm happy to do what I do and be left alone and keep quiet. Now, some people would say that's a shame because somebody, you know, they used to say Michael Jordan or others, you know, didn't use their platform for good of society. He didn't see it as his job. He knew he was making a contribution to the world, but he was mostly just doing what he loved from the time he was quite young. And, you know, he started out with no leverage, no power, so much so that it's also sort of a relatively well-known story. He intensely disliked the name Peanuts. He thought it was sort of demeaning, and he didn't choose it, but he had no authority when the syndicate initially chose it and sort of foisted it on him.
Well, why did they choose Peanuts? Do we know?
I think the backstory is, I think it was initially going to be called Little Folks or Little Something, and they decided it was too much out, Little Abner, and there was maybe another strip with Lil in it. And so I think the story I remember reading was that, I guess on the Howdy Doody show, there was something called the Peanut Gallery. And somehow it derived from that. But, you know, now I think a lot of us just sort of feel like, well, that's the right name for the strip just because we're so used to it and it's so beloved. But he almost refused to say it. He just would say, you know, if somebody said, who are you or what do you do? He would just say, oh, I draw a comic strip with Charlie Brown and his dog and some other kids. But he would have been just as happy, if not much happier, to just call the strip Charlie Brown or almost anything other than Peanuts.
Mm. Of course, Peanuts, the strip, was, I don't know what the figures are, but it was, you know, nationwide, it was worldwide, right?
Yeah,
millions
absolutely.
And millions of people were reading this.
The numbers are awe-inspiring and almost impossible to believe. 355 million people reading it, I think, at its peak, 2,600-plus newspapers carrying it, and again, 50 years of this. As someone, I think Robert Thompson is a professor at Syracuse, I think, said it's the longest running story ever told by one individual, because in a sense it is one story that he was telling over the course of 50 years. And yes, translated it to dozens of languages throughout the world. And then obviously for a lot of people, the gateway was were the holiday TV specials. But, you know, some people, I think once if you were weaned on the TV specials, you had the characters' voices in your head. So that sort of took away from the purity of the strip in some sense, but to your point, it was absolutely a transcendent, and not just in this country by any stretch of the imagination, phenomenon.
I don't know if you, you know, talked to him about this or if you've seen it. What did he make of that? The extreme popularity, it touched a nerve with so many people.
Yeah, he seemed to be funny in the sense like he knew he had made a contribution and had talent, but, you know, if the flattery got too much, it seemed like it was almost like a thermostat that shut down. He'd say, "But I'm not." He'd always say, "Like I'm not Andrew Wyeth." You know, if you said, he would just say, "I'm a cartoonist. It's what I do." And you know, the themes. People like to say it's a deceptively complicated strip where there's a paradox on some level, both in the artistry of it and the characters in the story. There's some levels on which it's straightforward and simple, and there are other ways in which it's very deep and complicated. And you know, there's a strain of an argument of, was it actually dark, or was it, as Chris Ware, who's in the book, said, it was just real. And but it was arresting in a way to a lot of people, especially because it was populated exclusively by children. And I think someone put it that, you know, up until Peanuts, most comic strips were populated by grown-ups who acted sort of like children. Here were children who had some very grown-up ways of thinking and talking and experiencing life, and so much of the lives that they experienced were, you know, about how life can be hard and perseverance is required, but happiness and joy can be found in small pleasures, and there's a lot of unconditional love, and, you know, but I don't think he had any aspiration for it to become what it became, and I don't think he had any anticipation that it would.
Mm. You're a fan, right? You you know, love the strips. What did you take? Why did you keep coming back?
Well, it's funny. You know, you said it sort of as a rhetorical statement, which makes sense. But I know there are people who do certain kinds of work, and they're not necessarily fans. They just, you know, put together books or do certain things just because they think they'll sell or they're good ideas. And I have no skill or ability to do that. But this is born complete. You know, as are my other collections, be it about the Beatles or baseball or Central Park or coaches. But here, you know, I had my plush Snoopy, and from the time I was probably the same age my son is, who's five, who has a Snoopy pillowcase on his bed, and I think I was one of those people who did start with the holiday TV specials, and, you know, I didn't intellectualize it at all as a little kid, as far as analyzing or understanding what I was connecting with, but, you know, there's a piece in the book by Rick Moody that speaks for, I think, a lot of people who, you know, were endeared by it and charmed by it and connected with it when they were kids, and then it sort of went away, and it's when you start having kids of your own that there's a new portal into it, and it can be, again, the same with the Beatles or Frank Sinatra or baseball or whatever it might be, that you now experience it through, you know, your child's eyes or heart. You know, the melancholy aspect of it, which was part and parcel of Schultz's personality and life, and that's well documented. My friend David Michaelis wrote a phenomenal book called Schultz and Peanuts, which, you know, extensively documented that Schultz experienced a lot of depression, or melancholy was always the word. And, you know, I think part of the explanation for why, you know, 33 people chose to write about this subject 20 years after Schultz has died, 70 years after the strip started, you can't do all that if it's something that's just sort of warm and fuzzy and cuddly. There's got to be kind of a profundity to it, right? So, and there was, and it is for me. I think about it all the time.
And you said Schultz said, "Well, I'm no Andrew Wyeth, right?" But there, you know, the fact that contributors in this book compared the strip to Chekhov, to Brando, they compare it to haiku.
Right.
I'm reading this, and it's not ridiculous to me. I mean, there's a connection there that you recognize. There's a universality there.
Right. Yeah. I don't think anybody. I've never heard anyone. Although maybe it's a self-selected group I surround myself with. But you know, Adam Gopnik, I think, has the first piece in the book, and he's the one who sort of likens, invokes Chekhov, and you know, it's just funny. It's just there's just something. You know, I was watching part of the impeachment, not to wade into politics, but, you know, Bill Clinton and Ronald Reagan, I don't know how much they could agree on, but they were, and Obama actually as well, were huge Peanuts fans. There's just something that sort of cuts through what otherwise, it's it's not a matter of polarizes us, but just divides us or that we can't agree on. But even within the Peanuts fans, like Adam Gopnik in the book and Peter Kramer, who's also in the anthology, the Peanuts Papers, you know, have different opinions of what, you know, whether or not Lucy was a very good therapist or psychiatrist after all. But, you know, some people don't like what Adam and others do of sort of elevating Peanuts into, it's not just into literature, but just sort of taking it to a place that maybe Schultz himself wouldn't have. But that's how we read it. That's how we experience it.
Yeah, once it's out in the world, then we take it as we will, right?
Well, yeah, I can't, like, that's putting it as well as anybody could, exactly.
Including many nations around the world, you could guess that this would translate well. These are universal themes.
Well, exactly. I mean, there would be an occasional reference to something kind of quintessentially or endemically American, I guess, but otherwise you're right. I mean, the themes, again, start with unconditional, there was unconditional love too, but there was unrequited love everywhere you looked. Charlie Brown and the Redheaded Girl, and Lucy and Schroeder, and Sally and Linus, and, you know, as far as I know, that exists throughout the world, as does, you know, affection for our pets and friendship. And, you know, I mean, speaking of pets, I mean, there's a it's not a debate, but there's a difference of opinion about sort of Snoopy's role as the strip evolved. I mean, a lot of people, the consensus is probably the heyday of the strip was in the 1960s, and the turning point of the strip was when Snoopy got up on two legs, that he stopped sort of just crawling around like a dog. And then there's another population of people who think it became too much about him, and there's even a piece in the book by Sarah Boxer all about Snoopy's narcissism. So I think, you know, there are probably slightly different conversations or reads or debates in different parts of the world or in different parts of this country. But again, it's I don't know anything else that lasted as long as this did that continues to resonate the way this does. It begs this question. I mean, people have likened this to Mr. Rogers, Mr. Fred Rogers, and there's sort of a renaissance. I mean, I don't know if this is a sort of a new Peanuts moment that we're in. There's a new production of You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown that's going starting around the country this year, which is the most produced musical piece of musical theater in history, and there have been something like 40,000 productions of it. There's a new, you know, Peanuts app. I mean, I just don't know whether, I genuinely don't know if there's been a renaissance, and if so, for what reason. Does it have something to do with the values of, you know, Fred Rogers and Charles Schultz, who were two guys from the Midwest with good values, and is there something unconscious at play that's sort of drawing us more toward that, given the climate we're in? I don't know. But I just don't know whether there has ever been a lull or a lag, and I keep coming back to comparing it to things such as the Beatles, that, you know, they never fade away, but they just sort of seem to spike or resonate in certain ways at different points in time for different people.
Well, let's take a break. We're talking with Andrew Blauner. He's editor of a new collection. It's called The Peanuts Papers. 33 writers and artists speak about the deeper truths of Charles Schultz's deceptively simple comic Peanuts, its impact on their lives and art and on the broader culture. And we'll have the editor, Andrew Blauner, for the hour.
This episode of Access Utah first aired January 2020.
Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking about the beloved comic strip Peanuts and Charles Schultz, the creator. There's a new anthology out. It's called The Peanuts Papers. 33 writers and artists reflect on the deeper truths of Schultz's deceptively simple comic, its impact on their lives and art and on the broader culture. We're talking with the editor, Andrew Blauner. So Andrew Blauner, you may or may not know, one of Schultz's daughters, Amy, lives in Utah. I was reading an article just from a couple of years ago in the Deseret News, local paper here. She highlights his decency. She says that's the one reason she thinks the appeal of her father's strip. And she tells this story. She says, I distinctively remember walking into the room where he'd be in the middle of drawing a strip. He would immediately stop drawing, and his availability led her to conclude he didn't have a job when she was young.
Right. Well, yeah, I don't know. My son wandered in where I was working last night, and he said, I wonder if he understood that what I was doing was part of a job. But I didn't know that Amy lives in Utah now. I should have. But and you, that's a perfect word. Decency is as good a word as any. But, you know, who knows? But I think Schultz seemed to be the kind of person who, if he just was allowed to do what he did and the reception was nothing remotely close to what it was, he was just doing what he loved. And I can't speak for him, but whether he enjoyed, you know, the worldwide, I don't think he wanted any part of the fame, but whether we all want some sort of validation or affection or admiration, you know, it was just inspiring to me who he was and how he lived.
Amy goes on to say that she never heard her dad swear in his life. The word he would use is rats, she says,
yeah.
And that appears in the strip. That's what Charlie Brown says.
Exactly. He just, when I was with Schultz, he probably not the first or last time he said it, but he said he doesn't believe in. It always stuck in my head that he said ugly words, and he meant curse words, swear words. That he said basically that rats and good grief, you know, should cover, and good grief, you know, he obviously used and his characters used in all kinds of ways. But yeah, and I, you know, it's sort of, it's something that I've heard people kind of, you know, brush aside or characterize as being, I don't know, whatever people say, prudish or whatever. But I, you know, as someone who works in publishing and with writers and writing, there's a lot of that that resonates with me. I think, you know, language matters a lot. And in addition to everything else, I absolutely positively respect the fact that that he spoke and wrote that way. And I don't remember this, but I assume he also probably didn't drink and you know, just tried to live the life of a decent human being. Mm-hmm. You know, I think his religion sort of evolved. His spirituality evolved as time went by. But I think he was always a decent human being.
There's certainly issues of faith in Peanuts, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, especially Linus, who's in whom, you know, the intellect is there, but also the questions of faith and the Great Pumpkin and
exactly, yeah. That's sort of quintessential manifestation of it, I guess, which engenders people thinking, well, was there some symbolism? Was it, you know, blind faith in some higher power, or was he just a kid who just wanted to believe in the same way, you know, we want to believe in the Easter Bunny or the Tooth Fairy or Santa or what have you. But, you know, Linus, yeah, he was the philosopher king. And actually another thing Schultz said, not to me, but just in an interview somewhere on Earth, that someone asked him, like, so if the characters were real and they grew up to be grown-ups, you know, who would sort of be the most, get the exact word, but well-adjusted or successful or whatever. And he said, sort of without missing a beat, that he thought it was Linus, which I think surprised a lot of people, because people would think, well, Linus was way too, what, sensitive, if nothing else. But yes, the elements of faith and spirituality, and again, there's a stoicism to Schultz in his life, and you know, one of the surprises to me in putting this book together was how much affection and admiration and connection there is out there for Charlie Brown himself, who I think other people think, well, he was just kind of depressed, or I can't stand the word loser, but you know, I saw someone apply that once, and instead, a lot of people. I mean, again, maybe it's a self-selected group, but people in the book sort of, I really identified with him. But you know, I guess that's part of the peeling the onion. I mean, people also really thought Lucy was a strong, independent, sort of ahead of her time, very young woman, and a lot of people had a lot of respect for her and connection with her. So I don't know where we go from there.
One thing I think maybe we would want to have had Schultz do is to manufacture happy endings, but that's part of the power of the strip. He never did that.
Yeah. That's also a great point. Yeah. I remember reading somewhere, someone asked him, can you just let Charlie Brown kick the football once, but
right,
not have Lucy pull it away. And that, by the way, I think Ronald Reagan was on record saying that was his favorite aspect of all of Peanuts, was that sort of running gag, which Schultz said, you know, I think, I don't know what year that actually made its debut, but I remember reading somewhere that it lasted for about 40 years. So, I mean, that's a challenge in itself to sort of create. I mean, I think after a while we all sort of got the feeling that, you know, she was going to pull the ball away. But, you know, again, to your point, maybe not. Maybe we have sort of some, whether it's sort of unwarranted, but sort of faith or confidence or hope, cockeyed optimism, that maybe he will. But Schultz would just say it wouldn't be funny then. And I guess for him, it wouldn't be, again, I don't know what word he would have used, but it just didn't feel real to him. That there's a lot of cruelty in the world, and if somebody was like Lucy would always pull the ball away, yes, you'd love to believe that at some point she would let him kick, but no. I mean, there were probably other tropes like that. I mean, Charlie Brown's baseball team almost always lost, and he couldn't fly a kite. And there were all kinds of sort of almost parables like that, right?
I think we all have times where we say, oh, good grief, right? Or Charlie Brown leaning his head against the tree.
We have it in the publishing business where, you know, you're just trying to get good work by good writers and good stories told, and sometimes you just can't get past the gatekeepers, but there almost always is a happy ending because, you know, there's so many ways to get books published. And in this case, I'm glad this came up because I buried the lead here. I'd be woefully remiss not to mention the publisher of this book is Library of America.
Yeah.
In my view, not just arguably the best publisher in the country, but really a cultural institution, speaking of cultural institutions. And I encourage everyone to seek out other books by Library of America. So that's my brief advertorial for my publisher.
Yeah, Library of America, that's big that this book is being published by Library of America.
It was you can hear I'm sort of speechless about it even years later. I couldn't believe my good fortune, and it's just been a great experience. But more than and in addition, it does speak to, it's not the kind of book, the kind of topic that on the surface they usually would publish, but it's because, not just because it was a really popular comic strip, but that Schultz was a great American artist, and that's what Library of America celebrates, among other things. And the fact that the book is comprised of, you know, in addition to some cartoonists themselves who write exceptionally well, it's some of the best writers in the country who, after all these years, are still, you know, Ann Patchett, like a lot of people, I think, you know, the first writer she ever knew, per se, was Snoopy. And I think she basically says, without Peanuts, she probably would not have become a writer.
Hmm.
So you just sort of extrapolate from there.
If you just joined us, we're talking about a new collection. It's called The Peanuts Papers. 33 writers and artists reflect on deeper truths of Peanuts, Charles Schultz's deceptively simple comic, its impact on their lives and art and the broader culture. We're talking with the editor, Andrew Blauner. Umberto Eco contributes a piece. And we're on public radio here, so I'd be remiss if I didn't mention Ira Glass. Ira Glass talks about, he responds to Charlie Brown.
Well, right. Again, one of the welcome surprises was how many people responded to Charlie Brown. But just to address your first point, Umberto Eco, as many of your listeners know, is no longer alive, which signals to people that not 100% of the contributors to this book wrote original pieces. And he wrote something, I think it was originally in the New York Review of Books, that was just on the subject and just too good to not include, as are about, I think, 7 or 8 of the 33 pieces are, you know, archived, previously published work. The other 24, 25, 26. Ira's is actually sort of a hybrid, and I know Ira a little bit, and he's obviously an American icon in his own right. But the part of the chore of putting this kind of book together is to have sort of a variety of points of view and demographics and perspectives. And if I had an apprehension going into it, it maybe was, everybody's going to write about Snoopy. And that was far from the case, because you have people, Gerald Early writes about the Vince Guaraldi jazz, the music, which, you know, plays such a huge part of the TV specials. And And, you know, some are sort of character portraits, and again, not just of the so-called major characters, but Alyssa Chappell writes her piece about Sally. I mean, Jennifer Finney Boylan writes about, well, sort of a collection of so-called outsiders, and Peppermint Patty and Franklin, and, you know, it's much broader and much deeper than I think a lot of people realized.
By the way, Ira Glass says he didn't find the strip funny. He enjoyed
it. Oh, sorry. Yeah, exactly.
I wasn't saying. I was just going to appreciate you delineating those others. But I just wanted to go back to that because that struck me. But as I look on my enjoyment of the strip, you know, I laugh a lot, but I enjoyed it on many levels.
Well, it's such an for lack of a better word, interesting point, provocative point, because, again, talking about Good Grief and Rats and language, you know, I mean, something's quote-unquote funny. I wouldn't be shocked if I never laughed out loud at Peanuts, reading the strip or even watching the TV specials. That doesn't mean I didn't think it was funny or fun or all kinds of things. So when I read that Ira wrote that, I didn't sort of blink. It didn't surprise me, and it's not mutually exclusive with somebody appreciating it in different ways on different levels. But to me, Ira always has sort of an interesting, often different narrative or perspective on things. So I was really elated to have him in the book and his voice in it.
You mentioned earlier, I want to make sure we talk about this. You mentioned earlier that the reason you reached out was this anthology on mothers, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Schultz was very, you know, very influenced by his mother, very affected by her death.
Oh, for sure. Probably definitely the seminal event in his life was his mother's death. And, you know, there's just this poignant scene that I can almost re-experience the first time I read it. And then much less when I heard him talk in that interview, which was A&E biography, whatever. And he was going off to war, and I guess she knew how she felt and what was going to happen. And she said, "Well, Sparky," which is what, you know, everyone who was close with him at all called him. I could almost get choked up thinking about it right now. She said, "I guess we should say goodbye. I guess we may never see each other again." And wow, I mean, I just think he. I don't want to ascribe, you know, trauma to him, but I just think it was a defining, seminal, profound moment, only because, again, yes, that relationship was so freighted and fraught in great ways, but, you know, it was a terrible, terrible loss for him. And so, you know, is it coincidental then that there's so much, if not loss, but sort of difficulty, sadness, you know, things in the strip. There's not much death, I don't know what else to say other than, yes, I agree with you, and that was I don't know what Amy or the rest of his family would say, but I can't imagine there was a more important event in his life. And again, that book that eventually was published called Our Mother's Spirits, you know, is a chronicle, a tapestry of all men writing about, you know, again, a relationship men with their mothers, which, you know, in some cultures is sort of verboten, and, you know, there's something sort of unspoken about it. But,
I want to read this. This is Bruce Handy writing about Schultz. Bruce Handy says, "What I took away from Schultz is that life is hard, people are difficult at best, unfathomable at worst, justice is a foreign tongue. Happiness can vaporize in the thin gap between the third and fourth panel, and the best response to all of this is to laugh and keep moving, always ready to duck."
Mm-hmm.
Which would,
yeah.
And then I reflect on the fact that these are children.
Right.
These are children who are saying these profound things, children who never get older. The adults are off stage.
There's so much in what you just said alone, but Bruce Handy, who's the author of a great book called Wild Things, The Joy of Reading Children's Literature as an Adult, I mean, he's got a great many credits, but and that line you just read, I think, was quoted in the New York Times review of this book. It's almost, I don't know if I could say this in good faith, but like, I was going to say, you could almost forget that they are children, partly because you don't have anything juxtaposed to it. There are, somebody said, you know, the only person who's, the only character whose parents ever appear in the strip are Snoopy's, and he's a dog. And, you know, obviously the riff of you hear the teachers or the parents' voices sometimes in the background, as I think it was Rick Moody in the book says, there's a great expression like trombone voices, wah, 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 you know, that thing we're all sort of familiar with. But, you know, there's never anything explicit about how old those kids are, the kids are. You know, I had a girlfriend once who said, I don't understand why you like those depressed little children very much. And I thought, that when she said it was a long time ago, I thought, I didn't think of them as depressed, and I didn't even think of them as little children. And then I started reading, well, yeah, they're probably about 4 years old, but that doesn't resonate. Now having a five-year-old, that doesn't really make sense. But, you know, neither does the fact that Charlie Brown has almost no hair. But they don't think and act and talk like any other children that I think any of us know. I mean, there's not just no parents, there's almost no furniture. I mean, they live somewhere in suburbia. We don't know where. You know, when I was a kid, there was a show on TV called Wonderama, Saturday or Sunday mornings, and the theme song was Kids Are People Too. And I don't know, I think on some level, even when we didn't realize it, there was, as children, there was something about the strip, and again, the holiday specials, that made us feel more understood.
Let's go to another break. When we come back, our last segment with Andrew Blauner. He's editor of a new anthology. It's called The Penis Papers, 33 Writers and Artists. It reflects on the deeper truths of Charles Schulz's deceptively simple comic, its impact on their lives and art and the broader culture. We'll have more following this break.
This episode of Access Utah first aired January 2020.
Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with Andrew Blauner. He's editor of a new anthology. It's called The Peanuts Papers. Many writers and artists reflect on the deeper truths of Charles Schulz's deceptive comic, a simple comic, Peanuts, which is at its height was read by millions of people around the world. So Andrew Blauner, I know in the local paper here, Herald Journal, every week at least they run Peanuts. I mean, it still continues. I don't know, but with decline of newspapers, I wonder what the future of Peanuts is going to be.
Yeah, another great question or issue to raise. I mean, I live in New York City, where, to my chagrin, as much as I love the New York Times, and I do, they don't run any comics at all. I think the Washington Post has never, from the outset, in 1950, has never stopped running Peanuts, as a Sunday strip, at least. There's a little bit of a contentious debate about, you know, there's so many young up-and-coming or sort of mid-career artists, cartoonists, who could really use that precious real estate as long as it's around, instead of continuing to, you know, sort of recycle, they'll say, Peanuts, as opposed to the way I think of it, which is, you know, there are new generations who are just getting indoctrinated. But to your other point, the sad decline of the print newspaper, you know, I'll confess I don't read any comic strips online. So I think if you're starting out today or any time in the last, whatever, 10, 20 years, you're hip to the fact that that may be the way that a lot of your work is experienced. But, you know, what the future is for Peanuts digitally as opposed to in print, I don't know. I have a feeling that, you know, if we're all here 20, 50 years from now, we'd still be talking about it and thinking about it.
Some of the pieces in the anthology are very quite touching. Kevin Powell, he says that reading Peanuts helped him escape, you know, at least temporarily from a life of poverty growing up.
Yeah. Kevin Powell, like many of the contributors of this book, I think I counted the other night, 21 or so out of 33, or maybe 22 out of 33, have actually voluntarily participated in, you know, promoting and publicizing the book with nothing to gain from it, other than continuing to want to tell their story, share their love. And Kevin, probably more than anyone else, sort of had the most raw, visceral, personal, emotional experience with it. There's nothing complicated in some sense or heavy-handed. He just, you know, he had it rough, really rough, growing up, and he found great solace and comfort and consolation in the strip. I mean, plain and simple, but he describes it in, as you say, a very poignant, almost disarming in sort of how transparent he is about it.
He says that the bit about the Lucy pulling the football away, that stood as a metaphor for his life. Can I escape the ghetto?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. You could employ all kinds of metaphors and analogies about, you know, the prisons or ghettos or traumas or things that we all have dealt with on different levels in different ways, as part of growing up. But, Kevin had some abject difficulties that he had to transcend, and I admire him greatly. But, you know, Lucy pulling the football away, in the scheme of things, you know, seems like a quotidian thing. But, yeah, it was symbolic, I think, to a lot of people.
There's a fascinating piece in the book, and a pretty good get on your part. You got Peter Kramer to write a piece on Lucy.
Well, thank you. And, you know, full disclosure, I know Peter's a friend, should I say this? Yeah, I think so much of Peter that he lives in Providence. I went to Brown University undergrad. And I think so much of Peter as not just a writer, but as a thinker and as a therapist, I almost thought of moving back to Providence, Rhode Island, to ask him to be my therapist a long time ago. And I also thought of trying to option his first book, Listening to Prozac, to make a film out of it. But he's a good example and one of the few examples of people I went to for this book, sort of harboring some hope that he'd take on a particular aspect. And because he is a psychiatrist in addition to a writer and a thinker and everything else, I was not so secretly hoping that he would write about Lucy and the psychiatry stand. And sure enough, he did. So that was a little bit of an inside job, but a very satisfying one.
And he, as I understand it, one of the things he's saying is that Lucy's brand of psychiatry is not so far outside the mainstream.
Well, right. I think that the low-hanging fruit would be for a psychiatrist, of course, would sort of dash Lucy's brand of psychiatry, which, again, Adam Gopnik kind of does. I mean, I think Adam wrote something to the effect of she's about the least qualified person to be a therapist he could think of. Whereas Peter, said, you know, the whole, came up somewhere in the impeachment, actually, the snap out of it or wake up. And, you know, I think a lot of people say that, you call that psychiatry, you call that helpful or empathy or, but yeah, it was, I don't think Peter was being gratuitous or sly at all. I think he meant what he said. And, you know, at 5 cents, and Lucy didn't even have a sliding scale. Anyway, that was a real treat.
Yeah, I got 5 cents, snap out of it is probably get your money's worth, right?
I don't know, sometimes you get what you pay for.
That's right. I was remembering one of my favorite bits, and this was not just one strip, but Lucy asks Charlie, do you prefer sunrise or sunset?
Mm.
And then he says sunset, and that, of course, that's the wrong answer. She says, I just can't treat somebody who's a sunset person. She leaves, and the in this particular strip that I pulled up, Charlie Brown, the last panel says, actually, all of us sort of preferred noon.
right. I mean, Charlie Brown had a great sense of humor in a way, even though he didn't realize it, and he in another way, he was sort of a masochist. But again, whether it's him kicking the football or Linus in the pumpkin patch, again, is it sort of blind faith and a certain kind of ignorance or lack of accepting reality, or is it kind of a hopefulness that that we could all actually learn from or benefit from? But Lucy, some people point out Lucy, you know, she never really got her comeuppance in a sense, other than, you know, she always was trying to get Schroeder's attention, and he was in love with Beethoven, basically. But again, as you pointed out earlier, Schultz did not concern himself with happy endings or tying things up in a bow. And I think on some very real level, that's that's one of the secrets to its success.
Yeah, I think we can all relate, right? We've all, or most of us, have had an unrequited love.
Yeah.
So Lucy for Schroeder, Charlie Brown for the little redheaded girl.
Exactly.
Never gets resolved, and hopefully in our lives it does get resolved. You find someone, but we've all had that.
Right. Exactly. I mean, even Snoopy's trying to get published. It's not unrequited love for another person, but you know, there's a lot that's so aspirational, and the aspirations don't always get met. But that's reality. And then other times, you know, there's just Snoopy's dancing. I mean, there are other things that are just unconditional joy and happiness and the simple things in life that make us and some of the characters happy.
By the way, do you have a favorite character?
You know, if the person in my position seems to often say, oh, gosh, no, they're all like children. I love them equally. I'm not saying that. No, Snoopy is my character. I do love them all in different ways, but there's a clear winner in my book. And on the other side of the room where I am, I can see something that symbolizes that. And so that's
Why Snoopy?
Snoopy
what is it about Snoopy?
It's funny. After all this time and all this time thinking about it, I couldn't actually tell you with any certainty. It would just feel like speculation that there's a certain, you know, whether it's an alter ego or living vicariously because of the simplicity or the joy that he has in life, or his slyness or his sense of humor, his freedom, his independence. I really don't know. I just know I feel it. And that has never gone away. And I just can't even contain, you know, sort of smiling about it in this moment. And again, when I see it in my son, I'm 55 and he's 5. And so there's a lot of common ground there.
There's at least one person in the book who related to Sally. We haven't talked about her yet.
I think it's Alyssa Chappelle, who was on the horns of a dilemma right to the last minute. I think the other piece she was going to write was going to be about Woodstock. But she chose Sally instead, who's kind of, I think, in her mind, sort of an underappreciated character, or somebody who gets treated as if there's a certain superficiality to her. And but, you know, again, talk about unrequited love. I mean, she has it bad for Linus, right? I mean, she's willing to sit in that pumpkin patch at least for a while. But she's also Charlie Brown's sister. And, you know, she's by, I guess, any standard, a minor character. But I was very happy that Alyssa chose to write about her. And just as some people, you know, there's no single solitary piece about Franklin, but, you know, people don't all understand that you know, he was kind of Schultz. There had never been, as far as I know, a black African-American character in a popular comic strip. A school teacher in 1968 or 69, I think, wrote to Schultz and said, given the state of the country and the culture and race relations, wouldn't it be good to have a black character? And contrary to what I said sort of at the outset of this conversation, if you gave him an idea, it was almost a surefire thing he wouldn't do it. Well, this he made an exception for. And because he read this letter, and I guess as he read the letter that I wrote to him, amid, you can imagine how much mail he must have gotten. But that was the impetus for him including Franklin. You know, Peppermint Patty, some people conjecture that she was a lesbian. He never said it. But Marcy sort of followed her around, or people sort of read into that. But, you know, again, this could have been more of a one-note monotone collection if everybody had just sort of waxed nostalgic about, oh, I used to have Snoopy paraphernalia as a kid, or what Peanuts meant to me. But, you know, without my having to do much, I mean, editor is really a misnomer, because when you have writers who are this good, it's really just trying to not, you know, you have to have the idea, but just not get in the way and not mess it up. And they just did a masterful job. That it is an anthology, and the root of the word anthology comes from, I think, the Greek or the Latin for a bouquet. And so this, you know, going back to that meeting with Schultz in 99, this was my best effort to sort of throw a bouquet to Schultz and the world that he created, and the debt that we all owe him, I think.
Well, that's a good place to end the conversation. We're out of time. In any case, Andrew Blauner is editor of a new collection, The Peanuts Papers. on the wonderful comic strip that Charles Schulz created, Peanuts. Andrew Blonder, thank you so much.
You're so welcome. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to the program today.